And when it was decided that we should sail for Italy, they delivered Paul and some other prisoners to a centurion of the Augustan cohort named Julius. And embarking in a ship of Adramyttium, which was about to sail to the ports along the coast of Asia, we put to sea, accompanied by Aristarchus, a Macedonian from Thessalonica. The next day, we put in at Sidon, and Julius treated Paul kindly and gave him leave to go to his friends and be cared for. And putting out to sea from there, we sailed under the lee of Cyprus, because the winds were against us. And when we had sailed across the open sea, along the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra in Lycia. There, the centurion found a ship of Alexandria sailing for Italy and put us on board. We sailed slowly for a number of days and arrived with difficulty off Cnidus. And as the wind did not allow us to go farther, we sailed under the lee of Crete off Salmone. Coasting along it with difficulty, we came to a place called Fair Havens, near which was the Sea of Lycia. Since much time had passed, and the voyage was now dangerous, because even the fast was already over, Paul advised them, saying, "Sirs, I perceive that the voyage will be with injury and much loss, not only of the cargo and the ship, but also of our lives." But the centurion paid more attention to the pilot and to the owner of the ship than to what Paul said. And because the harbour was not suitable to spend the winter in, the majority decided to put out to sea from there, on the chance that somehow they could reach Phoenix, a harbour of Crete, facing both southwest and northwest, and spend the winter there. Now when the south wind blew gently, supposing that they had obtained their purpose, they weighed anchor and sailed along Crete, close to the shore. But soon a tempestuous wind, called the northeaster, struck down from the land. And when the ship was caught and could not face the wind, we gave way to it and were driven along. Running under the lee of a small island called Cauda, we managed with difficulty to secure the ship's boat. After hoisting it up, they used supports to undergird the ship. Then, fearing that they would run aground on the citrus, they lowered the gear, and thus they were driven along. Since we were violently storm-tossed, they began the next day to jettison the cargo. And on the third day, they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. When neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small tempest lay on us, all hope of our being saved was at last abandoned. Since they had been without food for a long time, Paul stood up among them and said, "Men, you should have listened to me and not set sail from Crete and incurred this injury and loss. Yet now I urge you to take heart, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. For this very night there stood before me an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I worship. And he said, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar. And behold, God has granted you all those who sail with you. So take heart, men, for I have faith in God that it will be exactly as I have been told. But we must run aground on some island.' When the 14th night had come, as we were being driven across the Adriatic Sea, about midnight, the sailors suspected that they were nearing land. So they took a sounding and found 20 fathoms. A little farther, they took a sounding again and found 15 fathoms. And fearing that we might run on the rocks, they let down 4 anchors from the stern and prayed for day to come. And as the sailors were seeking to escape from the ship and had lowered the ship's boat into the sea under pretense of laying out anchors from the bow, Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, 'Unless these men stay in the ship, you cannot be saved.' Then the soldiers cut away the ropes of the ship's boat and let it go. As day was about to dawn, Paul urged them all to take food, saying, 'Today is the 14th day that you have continued in suspense and without food, having taken nothing. Therefore, I urge you to take some food. It will give you strength, for not a hair is to perish from the head of any of you. And when he had said these things, he took bread, giving thanks to God in the presence of all. He broke it and began to eat. Then they all were encouraged and ate some food themselves. We were in all 276 persons in the ship. And when they had eaten enough, they lightened the ship, throwing out the wheat into the sea. Now when it was day, they did not recognize the land, but they noticed a bay with a beach on which they planned, if possible, to run the ship ashore. So they cast off the anchors and left them in the sea, at the same time loosening the ropes that tied the rudders. Then hoisting the foresail to the wind, they made for the beach. But striking a reef, they ran the vessel aground. The bow stuck and remained immovable, and the stern was being broken up by the surf. The soldiers' plan was to kill the prisoners, lest any should swim away and escape. But the centurion, wishing to save Paul, kept them from carrying out their plan. He ordered those who could swim to jump overboard first and make for land, and the rest on planks or on pieces of the ship. And so it was that all were brought safely to land. After we were brought safely through, we then learned that the island was called Malta. The native people showed us unusual kindness, for they kindled a fire and welcomed us all, because it had begun to rain and was cold. When Paul had gathered a bundle of sticks and put them on the fire, a viper came out because of the heat and fastened on his hand. When the native people saw the creature hanging from his hand, they said to one another, "No doubt this man is a murderer. Though he has escaped from the sea, justice has not allowed him to live." He, however, shook off the creature into the fire and suffered no harm. They were waiting for him to swell up or suddenly fall down dead. But when they had waited a long time and saw no misfortune come to him, they changed their minds and said he was a god. Now in the neighborhood of that place were lands belonging to the chief man of the island named Publius, who received us and entertained us hospitably for 3 days. It happened that the father of Publius lay sick with fever and dysentery. Paul visited him and prayed, and putting his hands on him, healed him. And when this had taken place, the rest of the people on the island who had diseases also came and were cured. They also honored us greatly. And when we were about to sail, they put on board whatever we needed. After 3 months, we set sail in a ship that wintered in the island, a ship of Alexandria with the twin gods as a figurehead. Putting in at Syracuse, we stayed there for 3 days. And from there, we made a circuit and arrived at Rhegium. And after one day, a south wind sprang up. And on the second day, we went to Puteoli. There we found brothers and were invited to stay with them for 7 days. And so we came to Rome. And the brothers there, when they heard about us, came as far as the Forum of Appius and 3 taverns to meet us. On seeing them, Paul thanked God and took courage. And when we came into Rome, Paul was allowed to stay by himself and with the soldier that guarded him. Do keep that open in front of you. And a reminder that there's an outline of where we're going on those service sheets that you were given when we came in. There are few certainties in life. The famous phrase goes, the only thing that are certain is death and taxes. I think when the England cricket team are taking a battering, Australian batsmen are usually added into that list as well. But in the Christian life, what can we be certain of? Or what are the certainties? We've actually seen many of them in the book of Acts. The risen Jesus, directing the Father's people through the work of his Spirit, that the word may go out and lives may be changed. But today, 2 certainties that we see. The Christian life involves suffering, and the sovereignty of God remains a comfort. Now, these two truths are foundational. If we were to somehow capture these truths, make glasses out of the lenses of them, and put them on, the world would appear sharper, clearer, more vivid, because we would have them right in front of our eyes. That's our goal today, to understand that these doctrines right in front of our eyes make sense and indeed help the world to make sense. But these aren't easy truths either, are they? And suffering is real. And suffering is hard. It's hard if we're going through suffering to make it out of bed in the morning and get on with the day. Because we know that the day is going to include suffering. If we have loved ones who are suffering or friends who struggle and agonize in difficulty and pain, simply saying something like that God is in control is so often not good enough in those moments. It seems to almost bring about more problems and questions than it does answers. And yet, we do affirm God's sovereignty. That's the theological word for God being in control. He knows what is happening. Indeed, he is powerful over all things. Difficult truths to hold together. And then maybe this morning you're just exploring Christian things, coming as a visitor and thinking these things through. And you've thought about the dilemma that's sometimes called the problem of evil. You know, if God is supposedly powerful over everything, and he's supposedly good as well, why does suffering exist? Because suffering exists, then surely the God of the Bible can't exist. Because surely he'd do something about it. He would fix it. Well, all these things we see in these two certainties on display in another big chunk towards the end of the book of Acts that we're looking at this morning. The certainty of suffering and the comfort of God's sovereignty. The last few chapters have been Luke, the author of the book of Acts, travel writing, if we like, as the Apostle Paul has moved from Athens to Jerusalem to Caesarea, and he's on his way to Rome. And with the Apostle Paul and others is the journey of the gospel, going to the ends of the earth. And so it makes sense of Acts chapter 1, verse 8, when Jesus instructed his apostles to be his witnesses in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, to the ends of the earth. And it might feel as if we've been journeying through the book of Acts until the ends of the earth, because indeed we are at the final stages of that book. But it's reflected that structure all the way through. So the gospel has gone out. The first thing to see today is the certainty of suffering. That's certainly on full display as Paul is shipwrecked, isn't it? And Luke, the author of Acts, he makes it clear in volume one of his work, the Gospel according to Luke, that Jesus also suffered. He's called the suffering servant, the man of sorrows. And where does he ultimately suffer? On the cross, on behalf of sinners, that we might have forgiveness of sin. But it's so clear, isn't it, that the Christian life, it is also marked with suffering. We've seen throughout the book of Acts, the followers of Jesus suffer. The apostles suffer. Now, Paul suffers. You know, he reached Jerusalem. He was in the temple as a mob grabs him. He's rescued by Roman authorities. He's put on trial in front of the Sanhedrin. Then he's on trial in front of Felix. Then in front of Festus and King Agrippa. And this is over the course of years. Paul appeals to Caesar, as is the right of a Roman citizen, that he be tried in Rome. And so eventually he's sent there as a prisoner still. You can see on the inside of the outline his journey to Rome, I guess some of the lowlights of the journey, we could say. And just to orientate us, because there's a lot of detail, so have that open in front of you. The journey, it involves suffering. So chapter 27, verse 1, they delivered Paul and some other prisoners to a centurion of the Augustan cohort named Julius. embarking in the ship of Amadritium, which was about to sail to the ports along the coast of Asia, we put to sea, accompanied by Aristarchus, a Macedonian from Thessalonica, and the next day we put in at Sidon. But this is how travel in the ancient world worked. If you weren't traveling by land, you had to find a boat going to where you wanted to go, right? Likely going for the sake of trade, business. Or you had to find one that was willing to take you along for the journey as well. And you'd go to roughly the direction you wanted to go in. You had to get off in the port and try and find somewhere, someone going to the next leg of your journey and convince them to take you as well. And so, verse 8, coasting along with difficulty, we came into a place called Fair Havens, near which was the city of Lycia. Much time passed, and the voyage was now dangerous, because even the fast was already over. This is a journey of weeks and weeks in front of them, and Paul has advised them, verse 10, saying, "Sirs, I perceive the voyage will be with injury and much loss, not only of the cargo and the ship, but also our lives." Paul had now spent years of his life traveling. It would have been unusual for someone to be this well-traveled in the ancient world. You know, it's not a normal lifestyle. Most people rarely would have left the town that they grew up in, basically. Paul wants them to winter on the island. He knows that it's going to be a dangerous voyage. Centurion says, "No, let's keep going on the advice of the captain, the owner of the ship. They've got business to do. They don't want to lose out." And seemingly, things immediately go wrong. A big storm hits. Verse 18, "Since we were violently storm-tossed, they began the next day to jettison the cargo." That means they're throwing over the stuff that they were going to sell or trade. They're throwing it overboard. Verse 19, "On the third day, we threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. When neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small tempest lay upon us, all hope of our being saved was at last abandoned." Pretty amazing account from Luke there, isn't it? I once had a brutal journey to a Scottish island on a ferry. A couple of hours on a ferry, the whole ship by the end of it smelt pretty horrific as more and more people succumbed to seasickness. I was very, very glad to see land. Nothing compared to Paul's journey. Think just for a moment as an aside here, the detail that Luke is giving. You know, this is detailed enough that it has to be firsthand. Luke is saying he's accompanying Paul on this journey. But also compare it to sort of other ancient sources of seafaring journeys. And it's written in a very different style. Essentially, Luke is not a sailor, but he's writing an account of a sailing journey. And so lots of people have looked with a critical eye at this account and said, "Oh, it doesn't make sense as a sailing narrative in the ancient world." Well, it does if it's written by Luke himself. So have confidence in the midst of the details. This is an eyewitness account. And clearly, they've had a terrible time. All hope is lost as the ship is run aground near Malta. The centurion in verse 43, he orders those who could swim to jump overboard first and make for the land, the rest on planks or on pieces of the ship. And so it was that they're all brought safely to land. They land on the island of Malta, today a popular holiday destination. They had no idea where they were. And they're there for 3 months. You can see in 28 verse 11, after 3 months, they set sail from there. It's a rubbish end to a rubbish journey of Paul trying to get to Rome, or at least being sent to Rome, in order to face trial. It's an unexpected journey in some ways, isn't it? You'd think that the book of Acts, as we come in towards the end of it, you'd think it would be a triumphant ending. You'd think the book of Acts would read like a classic tale of overcoming difficulties and suffering and the gospel ringing forth triumphant as it goes out, as it takes Rome and goes from there to the ends of the earth. But it doesn't. You know, we're right in the end game of the book of Acts here. And in many ways, it's just as bleak here as it has been all the way throughout. And as if to add insult to injury, as they're on the shore a fire is lit by the locals, the freezing cold, rain, and shipwrecked. Paul is collecting some firewood and he gets bitten by a snake, as if he wasn't already having a bad enough day. It's a realistic life of suffering. And so, look, we need to remember that suffering is real. In fact, it's a certainty. It's the normal life. It's the Christian life. And certainly throughout history and all around the globe, Christians suffer. So maybe we're in the Wharf and we've just starting a grad scheme here or in the city. And with September comes a job move or something. Or we're at the stage in career where we get a change of boss and a change of team. We get a promotion, whatever it is. And we're thinking, I want to be known as a Christian. This is an opportunity. September's rolled around. I want to live for Jesus in the workplace, live a joined up, a consistent life. I hope all of us, that's our ambition. It can be tempting, though, to think, well, if I live for Jesus, be known as a Christian, then he'll have my back. I'll get promotions, business will be fine, I'll have a secure career, everyone will know that I'm honest, and I'll be recognized as such. That's not actually the promise of the Bible. The Apostle Paul, living all out for Jesus, suffers incredibly. Life is more like a raging sea. The Bible is realistic about the Christian life. We don't have a sort of personal umbrella protecting us from rain that people who don't follow Jesus don't have. The sun shines on all. The rain falls on all. We suffer the same as anybody else. You know, why was the Apostle Paul shipwrecked? He was on a boat to bring the gospel to the ends of the earth, to Rome. The storm comes. Paul and the centurion and the sailors and the traders and everyone else, all shipwrecked just the same. Christians get the same diseases, the same diagnosis, the same difficulties as everybody. I think of Michael Green, who was a vicar and then an evangelist, who was flat out in the service of God. He was working at my Bible college when I was training there. And he said one day, I've had a great opportunity recently for the gospel to witness in hospital to some staff and some patients there. Not making much of the fact that he'd had a heart attack at the weekend, and that's why he was there. Living all out, but still suffering just as much as anybody else. So maybe we're going through a really difficult time at the moment. If we are, it would be so little comfort, wouldn't it, to read the Bible and see everyone who had faith is living a life of sunshine, roses, skipping through without, you know, trouble or care. We'd be left thinking, what's wrong with me? You know, clearly I don't have the right amount of faith or the strength of faith or anything like that. But that's not what it's like in the Bible. In the Bible, we see real life, real suffering. We see that it is a certainty. And that's why we see that it is such a comfort that God is sovereign. There's a comfort in the sovereignty of God. God is in control, and nothing takes him by surprise. His will is done. God's will is that the good news in Acts goes out. And there have been difficulties, suffering, there's been opposition, there's been persecution, there has been riots, there's been lies, there has been death, there has been sadness, all throughout the book. What's been happening? The word has increased and multiplied. The word has increased and multiplied. The word has spread. It's just the same today as it was back then. Look at what Paul says in the midst of the shipwreck. So we're in chapter 27, in verse 21. He says, since then they had been without food for a long time, Paul stood up among them and said, men, you should have listened to me and not have set sail from Crete and incurred this injury and loss. I don't think he's saying I told you so, but I think it's an acknowledgement of truth. And verse 22, yet now I urge you to take heart, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. For this very night there stood before me an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I worship, And he said, "Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar. And behold, God has granted you all those who sail with you. So take heart, men, for I have faith in God that it will be exactly as I have been told, but we must run aground somewhere." It's God is in control. The men on this ship where Paul is a prisoner are actually inside God's plan. God has a plan for Paul and the others to survive the storm. He has graciously granted that they will be brought through it. Paul belongs to God. He worships God, and God is in control. The physical lives of these soldiers will be saved, and they'll see the power of God at work in that. The sea in the ancient world, it was often seen as a symbol of chaos and evil. It couldn't be tamed. And so you can picture this shipwreck as an attempt to stop Paul and the gospel reaching Rome, and by extension, the ends of the earth. But God is sovereign. He's in control. Now, sometimes God's sovereignty is abundantly clear to us. It's obvious. So in chapter 28, we have poor Paul being bitten by a snake as he gathers firewood. The onlookers, they initially assume this is a bad guy getting the justice that he deserves, having escaped the shipwreck of the sea. But he survives the snake bites. God preserves Paul, saves him. And those healings as well in Malta. In chapter 28, verse 8, it happened that the father of Publius lay sick with fever and dysentery. In the ancient world, potentially a death sentence. Paul visited him, prayed, putting his hands on him, healed him. And when this had taken place, the rest of the people on the island who had diseases also came and were cured. An incredible moment of God's sovereignty. There are moments where it's very clear God is in control. Maybe you've had moments in your own life where you can point to it and say, that was God's sovereignty at work. God is in control because of this moment then. We look back and say, God was at work there. Sometimes, though, we can get a bit caught up in that thinking. We're only looking for obvious times of God showing his sovereignty, looking for the miraculous and the amazing as an assurance that God is in control. We think we have a high view of sovereignty because we're expecting miraculous things. But we can sometimes then forget about God's sovereignty when things become less obvious or when things go wrong. If somebody's ill, or it must be because of the devil or badness in the world. Clearly, the forces of evil are at work. Folk who fall into that kind of thinking, it's quite a limited view of God. You know, God's only involved when it's obvious that something is going right. When things are going wrong, God must not be in control. It must be something else. Picture for a moment a sculptor, you know, an artist with a chisel in hand and a lump of rock in front of them. Sometimes big chunks fly off the sculpture, don't they? And then other times it's smaller taps, more precise. And then it's sanding on finer paper and polishing and buffing. And you might look at an artist, a sculpture, for hours and think, what progress are they even making as they are slowly refining a bit of their sculpture? And you don't really see until they take a step back and see the picture as a whole and appreciate the beauty of it. God's sovereignty can sometimes be very obvious. Sometimes it's less obvious. He's no less sovereign. God's sovereign work is not constrained to the so-called supernatural, but he is the creator and sustainer and ruler over everything, even everyday matters. He ensures that his will is done, even if we can't see it yet. Sometimes we just need hindsight. We look back and we can see God was definitely in control there, working, and I can see how. And sometimes we can't see it. Picture Paul fleeing from one place to another, and each place then a church starting as the gospel goes out. And we can look at that and say that was very definitely God in control, bringing Paul to those different places. Other times, we aren't told those details. We don't know. And sometimes, even with hindsight, we look back and we think, where was God in that moment? We don't know. I can't understand how God was at work. Why am I ill? Why have I lost the job? Why, no matter how many jobs I apply for, do I just never hear back? Why did the relationship end? Sometimes we just don't know. But God's will is done. So, does this sovereignty, God's will, does it mean that we just sit back? You know, we need to, we need to trust God as we act. So some Christians will speak a bit like, God's sovereignty is true and real and we believe it, so therefore, let's just sit back. God's in control, trust him. And it will all work out. Trust him, trust him, trust him. We can become a little bit super spiritual about it if we think like that. The tube always arrives on time because I'm a Christian, as if no other non-Christian ever gets the tube on time. This sort of thinking also leads to decision paralysis. You know, waiting to know God's will every moment to find out what we should be doing. Should I take this job or that job? Start this relationship or that relationship? Never seemingly taking just responsibility for ourselves. So, you spend any time in any kind of student ministry and you'll find young men claiming that God wants them to marry a particular young woman. They get into a relationship a few months down the line, that same young man is saying clearly God wants them to break up. Sort of never taking just responsibility as they act. Folk who treat God's sovereignty like this, as if there's no acting on our part. When things go wrong, find it easy to blame God's sovereignty, forgetting the certainty of suffering. At the other end of the scale, there are those who are big in taking responsibility. God has given us brains to use, and it becomes easy, therefore, to not trust God's sovereignty, because there's almost no need, because we're confident trusting in our own capability. But throughout this shipwreck account, what does Paul do? He trusts in God's sovereignty as he remembers the certainty of suffering as he acts. So he tells them in verse 22, this is back in 27, yet now I urge you, in chapter 27, now I urge you, take heart because of God's sovereignty, basically. But he also tells them to stick together. When the rocks and the storm seems to be prevailing, the sailors, they think, let's leave the prisoners and the centurion and everyone else and go in the lifeboat. But verse 30, as the sailors were seeking to escape from the ship and had lowered the ship's boat into the sea under pretense of laying out anchors from the bow, Paul said to the centurion, unless these men stay in the ship, you cannot be saved. And the soldiers cut away the ropes of the ship's boats and let it go. Paul holds the promise of God and its conditions not as opposing one another, but clearly together. God had promised that the sailors and everyone else, they would not perish. But Paul knows that they've got to stay in the boat if that's to happen. The warning from Paul is the means by which God accomplishes his purpose. So he trusts God and he takes action. He even tells them to take food, doesn't he? So verse 34, as the shipwreck approaches, Paul encourages them to eat. Verse 34, therefore I encourage you, urge you, to take some food, for it will give you strength. For not a hair is to perish from the head of any of you. You think, if he's going to say, yeah, not a hair will perish, then why bother taking food? But they've been 14 days basically without food, nonstop trying to survive a storm. They need their strength if they're going to end up swimming to shore. So Paul knows they're exhausted, they need energy, even as they trust that not a hair will perish. And so verse 35, when he said these things, he took bread, giving thanks to God in the presence of all, he broke it and began to eat. So we need to trust God and act. We can trust God's sovereignty and make wise and good decisions. We can trust God, his sovereignty, and remember the certainty of suffering. How does this help, though, if we're not a Christian? And we're struggling to see how a good and sovereign God, a good and powerful God, could allow suffering. Well, if we're approaching it from somewhere purely academic, as an objection to faith, and we're exploring things and we have this question, then we need to hear that God is also infinite, all-knowing. And if that's the case, then it is perfectly possible that he has purposes that we do not know about. We, his creatures, are not sufficiently able to understand. Do we see that the problem of evil, if it's an academic objection, it's an illogical one? If God is able to do something about suffering and is good, and suffering exists, the problem of evil says God can't exist. But those things are just simply not contradictory. If indeed God is powerful enough to do something about suffering and good enough for us to be mad about suffering existing, then our conclusion has to be that we are simply smaller than God. But if we're struggling with this question from a personal view, because we are suffering, then we need to hear that this sovereignty and power of God is a comfort. And that can be slightly shocking to hear. But consider the alternatives. If God is not sovereign, even over the certainty of suffering, then what are the alternatives? There is no purpose in suffering then. It is random. That is a far more hopeless position than the God of the Bible gives us. So we remember Romans chapter 8, verse 28. We know that God causes all things to work together for the good of those who love God, to those who are called according to his purpose. Now, that is true. But do we know why? No, not all the time. But in his sovereignty, we can cry to him and know that while Christ, the eternal Son, suffered on the cross, he is our Savior who said that we can cast our burdens on him. There's an old hymn that says, I must tell Jesus all of my trials. I cannot bear these burdens alone. In my distress, he kindly will help me. He ever loves and cares for his own. Jesus sympathetically understands our griefs, and he's strong to bear them all. He can hear our sorrows, including our angst and the depth of our pain. Because God is sovereign, even in the certainty of suffering. So what are the certainties in life? Well, death, taxes, Australian batsmen, nothing compares. The certainty of suffering indeed is real. We need to not be naive. We need to remember it. But so too, the certainty of God's sovereignty. Let us remember it. We're going to pause for a moment. We're going to reflect on what we've heard. We're going to continue in prayer.